Boker Tov, everyone. What I'd like to do is, hand out. It's bad teacher technique to hand out something you don't want someone to look at. But the bracha that we say when we learn is on here in transliteration. I think that would be useful. So if we could take some and pass them around, that would be really phenomenal.
Hi.
And we'll begin with a blessing, and then we'll continue.
Hi.
Ya da 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 da, diddy ya da da da, diddy ya da 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 da, ay ya da da da. Baruch Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Asher Ki Kidshanu Bemitzvotav VeTzivanu La'asok bedivrei Torah, la'asok bedivrei Torah. Hafoch ba, hafoch ba, ve'hafoch ba, la'asok bedivrei Torah. Tiri-ya-da-da-da-da, tiri-ya-da-da-da-da, ay-ya-da-da-da-da. Okay. I love singing that song, especially when I'm not singing alone. And yesterday was an incredible moment. I don't know if anyone who was here on Shabbat morning noticed. I didn't start it. Yeah. And it was the first time that I hadn't started it. And I looked at the person next to me and I said, wow, it's become liturgy. You know, like when it's beyond one person, it's actually a really cool thing. I actually didn't write the melody. It was written by my partner in song, Rabbi David Paskin. And so I just get to celebrate it with everyone. That wasn't, it was just magical. So this is hi. There's a prayer you say, by the way, when you hear a siren. It's El Na Rafan Allah, which means God, please heal them, both the people who are going to do the help and those who need the help. This is the first installment in a series that I entitled "Living the Mythic Life." It touches on many, many different realms. If you follow either the bright yellow flyers or online or wherever, the email blast actually just had the entire description, it means a lot of things. But the title, Living a Mythic Life, is already, I think, it implies a certain direction. What I want to start with, the first installment is mythic time. But before we can talk about time, we have to talk about myth. So what I'd like you to do, very, very briefly, I say the word myth, and for you that means what? So what does it mean? You hear myth, what's the implication?
Story.
Okay? That has meaning. Okay?
That may not be true.
That's not true is one answer. That may not be true is an alternative to that.
Made up.
Symbolic.
A foundational story.
Okay?
I'll go the other way and say a story that is true.
A story that is true.
Yeah, a story that's true even if it's
okay, right. I was... Now, what Sheldon just did is answered a question that I was going to have to ask, which was, what do you mean by true? In the conversation that happens in many centers of faith, regardless of what brand, to use the word true means radically different things. Radically different. Okay, anyone else on what myth means? Right. By the way, the famous speaker who was not actually such a friend of the Jews, Joseph Campbell, did a lot of work on the power of myth. When he died, much came out about his sort of legendary dislike of Jews. The Joseph Campbell Foundation has been fighting those allegations, but regardless, there is wisdom to be gained from what he managed to get out. He was a scholar of comparative religion and loved Star Wars. And the combination of both gave rise to, but what's truth? What's the force? What is the power that makes for salvation, as Rabbi Mordechai Kaplan would have called it? So in the conversation of myth, what we need to be able to do first is be comfortable with the term. Right? What is myth? Well, there are ideological myths. An ideological myth tells you how something came to be, why it is. So, when Apollo rides across the sky in his fiery chariot with wheels as bright as the sun, that tells you why the sun goes across. And in fact, in ancient Mesopotamian religion, Shamshu is the name of the god who does the very same thing. If you speak Hebrew and I say Shamshu, you hear Shemesh, which is our word for the sun. Okay? Now, what is very important is that the foundation of Judaism for some is based on such myth. And when I say myth, I don't mean lie. I do mean story, and I do mean foundational story. And I do mean that it was made up. Now, yesterday, when we heard a Dvar Torah, very much about the description of the Mishkan, our first place of worship, a portable one, many faces lit up when our Darshanit, who's right here, began by saying, if you take the Torah to be the literal word of God, as I do, several questions come to mind. That was a paraphrase. But that's a powerful statement to make. It means that what I will describe as myth, and also be comfortable personally saying, is a construction. Both sides of what I just said are very threatening to a traditional faith. And so what myth can't do for us in this community, I'm not talking about the global concept of myth, but what we cannot do with our discussion of myth is write out someone for whom the articulation of Judaism here is home. I want to say that a little bit differently, but I want to say it again, because the conversation that we're having right now, that will begin in a second, is one that could be very scary for many of us. And that's really important. If it weren't scary, if it didn't matter, I don't know that we'd show up. So mythic life, for me, was a phrase of magnitude, of intensity. It wasn't a description of a fabrication. It was truth that might not be fact. And for people like Richard Dawkins and all of the authors right now who are, and there's a French author, Michael Ori, whose book Atheist Manifesto is this incredible bestseller and was just translated into English about a month ago. It's a diatribe. But to disregard that attack is a mistake, but to let it be proof that faith is wrong is also a mistake. Because if I can talk about truth that is in fact, it's not about proving. And none of what I'm presenting today is an attempt to prove to anyone anything. Okay? Those are all apologetics, but they are affirmations as well. The faith that I claim, that I know many of us share, but I would never want to impose it on anyone. So, let's begin. Myth. We're not done with it, but if you'd like to see the beginnings of an analysis by a teacher of mine, Rabbi Neil Gilman, boy, am I thankful to you. Thank you. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam she'akol nehiyah bidvaro. So, my rabbi, Neil Gilman, who I learned with for about 11 years because I did my undergrad, master's, in rabbinical school at the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York, was a very tolerant person because I was not. And he was very loving. And my most fond picture actually is of him holding my daughter, Arielle. He became, in very many ways, family because he didn't yell back. He uses the word myth a lot. And he has an article which is accessible online. And actually what I want to say also, if you look at the top right corner of the page, there's Living a Mythic Life, Mythic Time, my name, and then a website. Right, rabbicreditor.blogspot.com. I just posted something late last night. Don't look at the hour stamp, but it was late. With five links. And all of the links will be relevant. One of them is the full text of this article by Gilman. Okay, so click on that site if you feel like it, and you can see Gilman's article. He's always been under attack for using the word myth. Always. And in fact, anyone who uses it in traditional circles comes under attack, because how could you say it's myth? Myth is mythology. Mythology is Zeus. That's not us. And in fact, the archetypes are very similar. It's a very brave act to be a faith practitioner and teacher and use the word myth. Now, that's not about me. In fact, I only grew up recently to use it. And in fact, I'm not even sure what all of the implications are. But he reflects on his own use of the word myth in his teaching of Torah. And he ends with a paragraph, which I didn't include here, saying, my colleagues have been begging me to use a different word. Please don't use that anymore. Use the word midrash. Use agadah. Use story. None of those are as threatening as the word myth. He said, but it works for me. And so I use it. And I like that because it's very, very much who he is. So I'm just going to read this quick. One, there's no totally objective human experience of the world. If I were to hold a pencil right here and drop it, people sitting next to me would see where it went, but Glenn would have to imagine what happened to it. And all of a sudden, there's myth. Because what's the objective reality? Why am I losing my voice? Is it because I work so hard? Or is it because my family is getting over strep throat? Or is it because I don't feel like talking loudly and I wanted to get you to listen better? Well, you won't know that. It's a combination of three. But what's the objective reality behind even that nuance of a decision? We construct reality from our simple perception of an apple to our most complex scientific theories. To this task, we bring everything that makes us who we distinctively are, our genetic makeup, our educational and cultural baggage, and our intuitive, almost preconceptual assumptions about what the world looks like. I am determined, and I know many of us are, to building a world of hope and of love. Does that mean that the world we see outside says that about itself? And as I say that, I've already made a construction. The world thinks of itself as not a hopeful place. It's our mission. Well, that's not true either. The world, in large part, is yearning for beauty and is building that, too. But in order to build a sense of urgency, and from this particular place, a sense of Jewish urgency, to respond to the needs of the world, we already step into a mythic structure. Jew or not, Jew by birth, Jew by choice, friend, family, whatever it is. I say something from the non-Bima, or in casual conversation about how important it is to be part of the Nitivot Knitters later today. That is a Jewish act. Well, it doesn't have to be Jewish, but we're a Jewish community. It's a Jewish act. Why do you believe me? That's part of the myth. But maybe we do that knowingly and willingly. Two, myths then are not to be contrasted with facts. That's Sheldon's point. Three, myths are the connective tissues that knit, I didn't do that on purpose, together the data of experience, thereby enabling these data to form a coherent pattern and acquire meaning. Gilman has used in the past the Knicks, the basketball team, the Knicks passing game. Certain seasons it doesn't exist at all, actually, but you can't discern it while you're watching it. But you know it's there. I hope it's there. Yeah, right, there you go. Right, actually, I should have looked at you, Lanzmann, right. Where Rollo May, in the cry for myth, calls the beams of the house that are themselves invisible, but without which the house could not stand. It is precisely because these connecting tissues are themselves invisible that myths are frequently viewed as fictions. There are no beams of the house. Well, you and I know that not to be true, but it's because we think the building, we know the building, we believe the building, needs the beams to stand. But what if we talk about the building of a community? What are the pillars? Are they invisible? Are they assumptions? A mission statement which we're embarking on as a community? It has to incorporate those beams. And identifying them as the core, that's a challenge, because then you're trying to figure out your own myth. Why am I? Four, myths can be living, broken, or dead. Paul Tillich is an enormous influence on Gilman in this. If you've read Paul Tillich's Dynamics of Faith, you hear this language being repeated. If you haven't, it is a great book. It wasn't written by a Jew, but it is for everybody, including the Jews. A living myth is one that works for us, that we embrace as, quote, true, that makes sense of the world as we perceive it. A broken myth is, and I didn't include Gilman's, with his permission, I've sort of edited his stuff sometimes when I present it. That's part of what I want us to think about. What's a broken myth? When is it broken? Can we not live it if it's broken? Five, what makes a myth true? Clearly not because it corresponds to the facts, simply because we have no independent perception of those facts to compare it with. We cannot escape our humanness, but one myth may do a better job, this is a great sentence, by the way, one myth may do a better job of integrating what we do perceive to be the data of experience. It accounts more adequately for more of what we perceive. For Jews, that myth is canonized in the Torah. I want to read that last sentence and then ask you to respond to it for a second and then move into the question of time. One myth may do a better job of integrating what we do perceive to be the data of experience. It accounts more adequately for more of what we perceive. For Jews, that myth is canonized in Torah. Okay. Steve is saying, it sounds like interpreting a text. I'm just going to paraphrase. There are many interpretations, but some stand out as really holding it, really explaining what it is. Good sentence. It covers more of what you find in it. Right? I'm going to emphasize the you. Yes. For those who didn't hear, it sounds like a description of scientific, what was, theory. Right. Though scientific theory begins as a hypothesis. Okay. No, that's fine. My rudimentary understanding is that science, while there is certainly ambiguity, especially when you're a sophisticated practitioner, there is the presumption of some answer.
No, that's a perfectly, if you change the word myth to theory, it's
good.
Or paradigm.
Fine. So I'm sort of fishing for this, because what it also leads to is the acknowledgement that religion is no less good at responding to the world than science. That is actually quite a profound point to make, right? For Dawkins and for others, and Sam Harris, who, there's a great debate between Sam Harris and Rabbi David Wolpe. You can get it at aju.edu. It's the American Jewish University. They hosted it. It is wonderful. They make the point that science is true, whereas religion is subversive. That religion pulls you away from an objective analysis of the world. But the presumption that science could provide that is itself suspect. To your point, Barry, Heschel's come under attack from some students of students for using the word objective. Heschel said that there is an objective truth that we yearn for. There's an objective need. There is the call to every human being. And he points to God as the call, and a Buddhist has a problem with that kind of a claim. But my understanding of the world fits very well with what you just said. By the way, there's a Danish linguistic, I'm going to look at you for this later, David, Sense and Possibility. Can't think of the author, but he uses Odysseus as an interesting term, because Odysseus never existed. He's a fictional character of the Odyssey, right? But Odysseus, so then the question is, what does this sentence mean? Odysseus landed on the beach. Well, he never existed. It doesn't mean anything. But the point of this article is, yes, it does. Because from the sentence, we derive meaning. So what does it mean for Nadav and Abihu, the sons of Aaron the high priest, who were consumed by the fire that went out from before God, Milifnei Adonai? Well, if I don't believe they existed, the sentence is meaningless, is the claim. And the answer is no. The sentence means a whole lot, because they do exist. If they influence the world, or me, thereby the world, they exist. The question of timing, however, by the way, is a good segue, and we'll get there in a second.
I just wanted to bring up the point that's come to me as a physician, is that we have in rational century, post-industrial revolution thought, have created science, have equated science with God, have put science in the place of God, and that we worship science in the ways that people pre-industrial revolution worship God. And therefore our sense of failing with people, when science or their science's practitioners fail us, it's as if there's a loss of faith.
Yeah.
And I think that when we sit up there and we set up this idea that it's science or God, we're not talking about different things. You know, it's science is another. Yeah. When people talk about it that way, they're substituting science.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, right. The example I've heard recently. My wife is in the middle of training for to be a childbirth educator through Lamaze. That Lamaze has transformed itself into a very different philosophy of birthing. Her investigation led me just to understand this very simple idea, which is that doctors used to deny the usefulness of midwives. But now there are so many midwives as part of general medical practice. There's a certain openness to not having all the answers, and a complementary nature between what was seen as folk and archaic, or whatever the word is, suddenly being a valid influence. Yeah, no, I think that you're right. I think also in a postmodern world, however, our certainty, both within the realm of religion, has changed.
In terms of these myths, there are a lot of parallel myths, blood myths, journey myths, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And that, you know, I think the longing yearning is very common to all of us, and that sense of wholeness or truth or whatever you want to call it, and that for Jews, the Torah is that opening. I'm going back to that last thing. But for Buddhists, it might be the Four Noble Truths or something like that. But the more I read, the more I learn, we all want to get to the same place. It's just a bunch of different paths to get there.
Everyone heard Ellen? Right. First of all, if you read Borstein's Funny You Don't Look Buddhist. All right, so, right? So there is something to be said about the complementary nature or the parallel journeying. But there is also something to be said for those who don't find themselves consumed by the question. I would like to think that the entire universe of humankind is interested in finding a point of light that can be shared in a nonviolent way. I don't believe that. I don't believe that, and part of the reason that I'm a conservative Jew and not an Orthodox Jew is because that world is a fundamentalist world that leads to the negation of the other. Right? The world that does not see something shared in this yearning is one that acts in the name of God or acts in the name of science to destroy an other. Now, the other might be a healthy, God willing, place of faith. Right? Because if you read the Atheist Manifesto and you agree with what Michael Oury is saying, what you end up doing is saying, Nebuch, those people sitting down in the pews, they're just yearning, and you know, they're not directing it. But the rabbi, I hold the rabbi to account for lying. Right? Whereas what we see ourselves doing in this place, and in many, many places, thank God, literally, right, is not judging each other, allowing for safe space, and for a shared purposefulness, even when our own degree of familiarity with the liturgy is radically different. We are a safe place for people looking to not be alone. That's why I come. But my way of articulating the purpose of a faith community is very, very different. And so I want to use the word objective. I want to say everybody's yearning. Now, within Buddhism, within modern Judaism, it's still not universal. It's still not. I want to jump into the question of time, but I don't want to cut off comments. So I'm going to take one more and then move on.
That the brilliance of Torah is that it opens with the myth of Adam and Eve, which illustrates human behavior better than anything else, and then goes into the story of all of our forefathers and mothers with their many, many flaws.
Good.
And the stage was set with the myth of Adam and Eve. I don't know if anybody believes that that really happened, but it's the greatest myth.
Yeah. For those who didn't hear Edna, there are many Orthodox rabbis who talk about the myth of Adam and Eve and the power of that myth as the first story in our Torah, A, in terms of their fallibility, B, that they're not Jewish. There is some incredible, incredible lesson to be learned from this story. But it isn't used always in the sense of myth. There are those who do take it to be truth. Those are the same people who argue that a day within the creation narrative is not a day that we understand it, and that's why dinosaurs fit into a religious perspective. Evolution can be part of it because of a gradual change in the sense of time. I'm using all of these as segues. Someone picked up on it. But it is true that there are Reform rabbis and conservative rabbis who talk about a fundamentalist vision of Judaism as their own, and there are Orthodox rabbis and Haredi rabbis who are incredibly expansive. So that's, I think, a very, very important and nuanced understanding of the world, which is to say, a brand doesn't determine openness, right? It is a very, very deep challenge, and as an advocate for gay inclusion in the conservative movement, I experience that only from the outside because I'm an advocate who's straight. But within the conservative movement, much of the language that was being used would shock and should shock a sensibility that I think we call home together. So I don't want to pretend that we have A, the monopoly on safe space making, safe sacred space making, or B, that we all, whoever we decide to be aligned with, feel that way. It's very, very important. It's part of a dynamic conversation. Time. By the way, to presume that we are going to accomplish, that's just not why we're here. So let me ask you just a very simple question which has many, many not simple answers. When are you right now? in your head, what moment do you occupy? Right, we talk about being present. Why do we need to talk about it so much? Somebody broke into my car last night. I'm actually sitting in my car at the moment looking at, well, they didn't want any of the books I have. I must have left the door unlocked because there's no damage, but I'm sitting there right now. You know, my kids are getting over strep throat. That's where I am right now. I'm a teacher teaching things that are incredibly deep, and I feel equipped in some ways to have this conversation. In some ways, I'm a fisher in the universe, and I'm trying to figure out how to be a conduit for healthy conversation with people who are my teachers. So where am I? When am I? We're right here, but that's not the only place we are. And I don't mean place as in location. That's not the only time we are. Within the Jewish conversation, I just want to read for you a list. You know this list. Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. You don't have this. Inside you do. Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Shmini Atzeret, Simchat Torah, Chanukah, Tu Bishvat, Purim, Pesach, Yom HaShoah VeHagvura, the way they call it in Israel, Yom HaZikaron, Yom HaAtzma'ut, Shavuot, Skip Lag BaOmer, Tisha B'Av. I say Pesach. I don't know what happens for you, but I think of the last Pesach my grandfather was alive. I helped him into the house. Suddenly there I was, a 14-year-old, helping his grandfather into the house. Right? And every Pesach is that Pesach. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Right? My head goes a million places, including a church all of a sudden. Standing in a church with a holy community of Jews. And how am I there right now? I'm standing at a podium in a social hall on university. So it is very easy to step into a different moment. When I talk about mythic time, when we might talk about mythic time, I think that's part of it. Because we're never really in one moment. There are very few moments when we're entirely in that moment. The birth of a child, the death of a loved one. Even then, we're actually very distracted. Not as much, but we're distracted. We talk about God. What moment are we really in? So I want to read you something. And for me, you might already know this. The jokes I make are in order to lighten myself up a little bit. When my daughter was born, it was March of 2002. My wife and I were expecting her to be born living in Manhattan on 9/11. My wife was working midtown, and it's not like we were the only ones for whom the world changed. The whole world changed. And I've never, ever gotten past any of it myself. So on November 18th of this past year, or I guess last year, I was just on the computer. Someone pointed me to a YouTube video. And I was watching some YouTube video. And, you know, you get the related links on the right side of the page. So I clicked on New York State of Mind, which is a great song by Billy Joel. And as a New Yorker, it evokes a huge amount. I know different versions of the song, which papers he refers to in the song, where he was for some versions of the song. But that's not what it did to me, because the version of the song that he was singing was the concert right after. It was called the Concert for New York. The Robin Hood Fund organized it with Paul McCartney. And all of a sudden, I wasn't in November of 2007, and I was not in Berkeley. And I did not have three healthy children, thank God. So this is what I wrote. And I don't think it's unique to me to have this kind of reflective moment. What can you possibly do in the words New York can bring you to both your warmest childhood memories and to your hardest moment of life? Cars lined up in the street all the way down Broadway, people aching to give blood, give anything. No cell phone reception. Suddenly it's 9/11 and you're simply never going to be again who you were just this morning. This incredible pain. If you were there, the shattered soul you own can break down looking at a policeman's badge, a fireman's hat, a person's face, a lost father's picture held by a child. How quickly we forget and how hard it is to find anyone who understands. YouTube is full of the videos from the Concert for New York, full of the faces of the audience still raw and reeling from rupture. Even Billy Joel seems to be working hard to get back into his New York state of mind. The music is a strained roar, a conscious refusal to die. Here I sit in Berkeley on November 18th, 2007, and I'm suddenly back in Manhattan on September 11th, 2001, scared, wondering where my wife is, praying my sister is okay, wondering what happened to the world, smelling the smoke, wishing it weren't so, leading mincha, and screaming the blessing against enemies so hard it hurt. There are moments in which comfort comes, but there are also moments that are inescapable, where aloneness permeates every pore. The broken city resonates in mythic proportion, and living in the moment means not feeling the distance of time or space, re-entering the encounter and breaking, willing or not. Seeing the stained sky, flying over ground zero and looking into the pit, in perhaps the same way that the birth of a child is an eternal moment, all these experiences are eternal. The internet was not created to do this. Airplanes were not created to do that. But all of a sudden, for any one of us, things shift with one stimulus. Just a picture. And I was smelling different things again. Just a picture. Now, that is such a scary thing to have shared. I want to make sure I don't leave it there, even though I will be there as we move to the next moment. Isn't picking up a sidur supposed to do the same thing? Right? Many of us leave on Yom Kippur during the Avodah service, where the high priest would go through this incredibly elaborate ritual. Many of us leave because we don't want sacrifice anymore, and we've been sitting for a long time. But you can't escape if you're present. You can't escape that moment. Because your life is on the line. If the Kohen doesn't do it right, everyone dies. What does that mean? And do we want to feel that kind of urgency? I think part of why we come to shul, part of why we come together, is to not be as scared. So why is a rabbi making us scared? It's not rhetorical. I'm not using this as a device. I find this kind of thinking to be the best kind of religious thinking. Because all the moments are intertwined. All the moments are intertwined. So in the same day, same moment, that I'm in tears writing what I just read to you, right? My children are snoring upstairs. And I go upstairs and I look at my kids and I remember the moment they were born. And Jewish tradition says, one life is the entire universe. And all of a sudden, I'm definitely not okay, but I can live. I can have hope. I can imagine a world that my children will make with all of our families, with all of our friends, into a better place. But I need to be able to get to that place. And the only way I can is by not living only in a moment I can identify. I bump my leg. That brings me right here, right now. I shouldn't need pain. So what does living a mythic life mean? What does it mean? So for me, 9/11 is one of those moments. The Challenger blowing up. I know exactly where I was. For many people, JFK's assassination. Right? Those are the moments we'll never forget where we were. The birth of a child. Hearing certain type of news. Right? All of that puts us in certain moments. But the regulation of the experiential diving board, which is Jewish tradition, is a way of getting to those moments regularly. So I'm going to read just a little bit more with you and then open it up. But for me, if we're talking about living a mythic life, which I think we are all called to do, and we'll talk about the call more another time, but I think we are called. And I would use the word universal, even though it sounds like I'm bullying. I think we are called to live in mythic proportion. So on your pages, Nina Beth Carden is a wonderful, wonderful teacher. And in the Tapestry of Jewish Time, a spiritual guide, it talks about holidays and life cycles. She writes, when the sun goes down on the sixth day and we light the Shabbat candles, we open up a portal in time and space. We stand before the candlesticks, circling our hands above the flames three times, gathering, collecting, immersing ourselves in their light. We take our hands away, quote, there was light. Everything is bathed in this radiance, borrowed from the first light of creation so long ago. We have walked through the portal into time eternal. What if you don't believe it happened that way? Does that really matter? First of all, you read this and you weep, and you're already lighting candles, even if all you're doing is holding this. Right? You're in that moment, which is itself at least as imagined, as the light of creation. And remember, that light, if you read Breishit, the Genesis account, that light didn't have a source. The light that was created didn't have a sun. It's not about things you can see. It's about an experience. quoting a little bit more, and this is, I keep on pointing to you, David. This is the edition of the Zohar that, David and Bill just donated to our library, but I'm holding on to for a while. If you're looking for a way into the Zohar, and that's a big if. Here's a note on a page. All right, so it's page 285, note 208. Don't ask. Al Mada'ate, or Olam Haba, or the world that is coming, is often understood as referring to the world to come. From another point of view, however, the world that is coming already exists, occupying another dimension. The wise call it Ha'olam Haba, not because it does not exist now, but for us today in this world, it is still to come. The world to come does not succeed this world, but exists from eternity as a reality outside and above time, to which the soul ascends. If you're looking for a fiction book that does a tremendous job of pulling you into this thinking, Dara Horn is an author, and the book is The World to Come. She is an emerging name on the face of Jewish thinking, Jewish writing. She's a PhD candidate at Harvard in Yiddish, and H-O-R-N. Her first book is called In the Image. Not as good, but it's very good. And just one more. Right. This is the play, the theatrical adaptation of The Chosen by Chaim Potok. That's great, by the way. Whose task is it to study Torah? The world? No, the world is Esav. The world is Amalek. The world is Cossacks. The world is Hitler, Yimach Shemo V'Zichro. Of whom then? Of the people of Israel. We are commanded to sit in the light of the presence. It is written, the world is like a vestibule to the world to come. Prepare thyself in the vestibule that thou mayest enter the hall. In gematria, that's the numeric value of certain words, of all words through the letters. In gematria, the words this world add up to 163. And the words the world to come out to 154. The difference between this world and the world to come is 9. 9 is half of 18. 18 is chai, life. In this world, there is only half of chai. We are only half alive in this world. I love this paragraph. Now, love it, laugh with it, smile with it, and watch what he did, what they did. The world is Esav. What's Esav? Just give me an adjective. Other, good, right. That's probably the most honest we could get. Esav is other, but in rabbinic tradition, not in biblical tradition, Esav is demon. Esav is Rome. Esav is Germany. Esav is, and he does it. Amalek. Purim's coming up. We know in our mythic understanding, and this term is so good to use, because imagination sounds too easy. But in our mythic selves, Purim is where we almost die. There's a Hasidic commentary that says that's why you drink. Because how else could you face it? God forbid we take that so seriously that we have to drink. But the impulse is understandable. Now let me ask you a question. What if they didn't exist? Hitler's the next person, right? The Cossacks and then Hitler. They did exist. To face that kind of threat as a person in the moment, right? We just had a staff meeting a few weeks ago and we talked about the tradition of opening the door for Elijah at Seder. Right? So why do we do it? So the kids will go and they won't see that we drank or pressed a button and half of the wine or grape juice evaporated or went away. That's not why. What do we say when we, right, what do we say when we open the door? Shvoch hamatcha ala goyim. Pour out your wrath on the other nations. Why do we say that? Why do we say that with our door open? Because that's an ancient tradition and boy must that have been a scary, scary moment. But instead of anticipating fear, you anticipate the Messiah. You anticipate redemption at the door. Now, I don't know if we get there. I think maybe being grown-ups is hard. I'll find out. But opening the door is terrifying because the blood libel. It's Pesach. Here's our matzah, guys. Come arrest and hurt us. Well, we don't necessarily allow ourselves to feel afraid. Pesach is a celebration. We make movies about it. Is it time to eat yet? Right? It's fun. Not entirely. We make jokes, right? You know, the Jewish holiday. What makes up a Jewish holiday? They tried to kill us. We won. Let's eat. Eat. Right? That's also pretty mythic for a Jew. Es mein Kinder. Right? Why is that so important to say? Because we couldn't. So when it comes to time, there's a lot more than what we're experiencing this second. It's easy to say. It's very hard to live. So we're not going to do this, the other side of the pages, but I gave it to you because let's read the one paragraph of it. Adin Steinsaltz, I just have to say his name for most people. He brings a lot of wisdom into the world. He is, according to Time Magazine or Newsweek, I forget which one, a once-in-a-millennium scholar. He is a teacher, and he's a mensch. I actually had simple story with him once, and I didn't learn anything because I wasn't paying attention. I was just too young and missed the opportunity, but he was very sweet then, too. So besides being a scholar, he's also just a nice person. God bless you. His book, The 13-Petaled Rose, is perhaps the most difficult book I've ever tried to read. He and Levinas really boggle my mind, and I try very hard with him. The 13-Petaled Rose is an introduction to Kabbalah, but it's not a book about Kabbalah. It is Kabbalah in book form, in English-ish. It is collected, The 13-Petaled Rose is its own book. It just came out in paperback, and I can't think of Dan's last name? Schifrin. Dan Schifrin, who's a member of this community, a preschool parent, and a really well-known author, and the new director of community programming for the Museum for Contemporary Judaism in San Francisco, and a new columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, recently interviewed Steinsaltz, who wanted to meet him because he wrote an article about trading in his Talmud. And they had this really wonderful conversation. It has yet to emerge as a recorded interview, but when it does, I think it'll be really wonderful to read. He got a copy of 13 Petaled Rose for me, signed by Steinsaltz, but signed by Steinsaltz meant Steinsaltz went. But I've got his scribble, and I believe it's his. So in my mythic life, I have a copy of. Also in a wonderful collection by Arthur Hertzberg, Zichrono Livracha, called The Strife of the Spirit, there is a collection of essays by Steinsaltz, which are really worth reading. The introduction from which this Xerox page is taken is here. Okay? Large introduction for something I said we weren't going to do. I bracketed on the right side of the page one paragraph. He's talking about four different dimensions of reality which are impossible to understand, but the core of classic mystical Jewish thinking. They are certainly part of the Zohar. They're quoted all over the place with little understanding, as I'm about to do. Time, too, is manifest in a totally different fashion in the higher worlds. In our experience, time operates and is measured by the movement of objects in space. Bless you. More abstractly, it is perceived as the process of change. The transition from state to state, from form to form, it is an essential feature of our concept of reality, of causality, which establishes the limitations of transitions within certain laws. In the higher worlds, the system of time becomes increasingly abstract, and its connection with the measurement of or perception of change is diminished. It becomes no more than the essence of change, or the potentiality of change. What I mean to say is, if you've ever thought for a moment that people who we have lost in this world are present, that's one way of saying, yeah, they really are. And the changes that happen in our life, when I rub my hands, I feel it. I'm causing it to happen, and it wasn't happening a minute ago. Well, in a different sense of, can't use the word reality, but in a different sense of truth, I've always been doing this. And I always knew what my hand felt like. And when as a child I began doing this, I was remembering it. Jerry just asked, what does this mean in terms of how you live your life?
How is life different by knowing this?
I want to repeat this version of the question. Two, how is life different from knowing this? I can assert, as an individual, that my life is radically different because I think this way. I can't impose it, nor do I think it would be the same for someone else to, you know, do whatever kind of thinking was sparked, internally or from reading. I think that life is meant to be lived intensely. Yitz Greenberg, who's a modern Orthodox rabbi, translates Kedoshim to you, be holy. Well, no one knows what holy means. He translates Kodesh as intense. Live intense lives, and the depth of that experience is God, who is Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. Right? Just, it's beyond intense. So what changes in life? I think every decision is laden with meaning. Now, frankly, who wrote The Short History of Nearly Everything? Is it Bill?
Bryson.
I can't remember his last name. Bill Bryson describes a philosopher who thought so deeply he just got up in the morning and sat at the foot of his bed for hours. That's what it could lead to. Sort of this self-obsessive, you know, everything I do has cosmic ramifications. When in truth, everything I do does have cosmic ramifications, and one of the things I could do is not get out of bed. Right? And so in many ways, I think your question is spot on. How does this change your life should be the question we ask as individuals to ourselves. How is this supposed to change my life? It doesn't presume an interior meaning to the idea. It presumes that in the interaction between me and the idea, I act in a salvific way. Nothing I do is neutral, and I have the opportunity, and I say obligation, to impact the world. So here's one of the ways it impacts, and this is the thinking of Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin, who I one day would really love to do a translation of his book, The Nefesh HaChaim. He says, if you ever feel helpless, you're wrong. Anyone who thinks that they can't have an impact on the world is wrong and forgetting what it is to be human. That's how it impacts the world. Because if we are connected cosmically, I am never alone.
My reaction to
what... You're welcome. Thank you.
...aspects of what I'm thinking. One is what happens in your everyday life. The other is what happens in your spiritual life.
Jerry just made a division that I don't like.
No, it's there. It's there.
So Jerry just said there are two different dimensions... So maybe responses or integrations, whatever, of what we're saying. One is into your everyday life and one is into your spiritual life. I think the problem is when we bifurcate our souls, is when I see the way I'm driving not as full of mitzvah opportunity, right? There was a president of my shul back in Sharon who his presidential address was, it began like this and ended like this, really. How many times a day do you do this when you're driving?
Only in Boston.
No, we don't drive here. We glide on scooters. but in fact, the ethical dimension of driving, meaning go ahead. I needed to Rashi my own. The ethical dimension of driving should be seen as a spiritual act. Because, you know, you don't have to see the movie Pay It Forward. I had to do one movie reference. If you've seen the movie Pay It Forward, you know that a simple act can have drastic positive consequence or negative. And so my spiritual life is just as lived in the car. In fact, because my children are the ages that they are, I rarely, barely attend morning minyan. I daven in the car. Which means I have to really be focused on the road first and use my spiritual soul at the same time. That is ultimately an integrated way to live life, not a bifurcated. So if I take any action as casual because it's a weekday act, I'm forgetting that chol can be turned into kodesh, that the, quote, profane could be made holy.
I don't intend a bifurcation by what I said. Suppose that you attain a very spiritual life. It won't make you richer. You won't have more money. But something is different about you and the way you live.
So Jerry said, you can lead a spiritually fulfilling life, but it won't make you richer. What it will do is tell you that it doesn't make a difference. Right? A not-for-profit versus a profit organization knows that. Right? A not-for-profit does not exist because it has a hope of breaking even. That's not what it means to feel purposeful in the world. Don't laugh. That's not what it means to feel purposeful in the world. I don't do this because I make a lot of money. I definitely don't do this because I make a lot of money. But I am driven to do this. And by the way, just to be, you know, totally transparent about this, in the same way that I feel an obligation to the Jewish people and to the world, I also am called in my obligation to my children, to my family, to myself. And if by not advocating for my own health as professional who feels called in a purposeful not-for-profit, I'm denying the mitzvahic part of my other mundane-ish, which is not mundane at all, life. So in a certain sense, yeah, there's stuff you hold and stuff you feel. But if what you feel doesn't influence the way you treat the things you hold, that's gashmis. That's right, the worst materialistic. Now, I'm not saying your point to that. But what I'm saying is that to not infuse the everyday with this kind of mentality means we miss opportunities to ascend in many ways. Right? What is it to make a donation to a shul? What is it to buy the watch that I need, not the watch I want? Right? Those are really two different things, but they're pretty much premised on the same sense of priorities. Why do I do the things I do? None of it makes sense. Getting a nicer watch doesn't make any sense, nor does making a donation to anything make any sense. I need to feel secure. Right? The real estate market does not do that for me. But the Sidur does, even when I disagree with it. We'll talk about that another time. We have a few more moments, and I don't want to close off if anybody else... And obviously our conversation is not done. It's part of a six-part series, but boy, is it bigger than a six-part series to choose this kind of a topic. And so I am really indebted to all of you and to Art and to Ron and to the people who helped organize every part of the Sunday morning chevra that emerges. This is really good. It's a very great context for talking and learning together and for having some nice coffee. So I'm open if people have maybe a last question or two. Michael?
It's not a question. A book I read in the book, at the beginning of the book, says, ask someone how they were born, and you won't get the facts of how they were born, you'll get a story.
Right.
You'll learn much more about that person from the story than you'll ever get from the bare facts of how they were born.
Totally.
It's not just a foundation.
Right. Thank you. What was the name of the book?
Oh, it's just 13th Story. The 13th Tale, kind of a gothic mystery, but had a great story.
If you're looking for a book that focuses on that type of sort of self-storytelling, but interactive storytelling, I'm actually thinking about using it for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur this coming year, so don't steal it. But the book is called Listening is an Act of Love. It's by an organization called StoryCorps. StoryCorps is known on NPR and all over the world, and they, in fact, demonstrate how to ask each other the deepest questions in life and how to share them. And I think it would be a really interesting thing to do to archive our community's senses of self in much the way that Ram, thank God, is recording this talk. I think it would be nice to hear each other's voices. It would be nice.
There's a piece of what you said there.
Tell me if I repeat your question authentically enough. In this presentation, I've been saying something like, let's just use the word myth and not fight about it in the way that it causes such tension in usual conversations. Truth, fact, God, biblical origin. Right? Let's talk about a mythic framework, not worrying about where it came from. Right, okay. So leveraging on the first part, which is to say, that's what we have. That's the Jewish fabric. That's the path. It is useful to, it's compelling enough that it exists and that we have it so that we can use that as our way into helping and responding with the world, right? The only shift that I would be more comfortable with in the way that you reformulated it is our mythic framework is one way in to helping the world. it need not be the only way. In fact, the concert is a lot better, sort of the dissonant noises, the multiple variations on our own theme. Right? There's something to be said about finding purpose in self and recognizing that the other can be just as purposeful. So I would want to make sure that in the same analogy with medicine, you really want to get to that point and you think you might get it and then you realize that you're guessing, you're pushing, you're an artist trying to weave with the best of your skills. Right? So too with Judaism, so too with Islam, so too with Christianity, Buddhism, atheism. We're all reaching for health. Amen. Amen. Yeah. Yes. That would have been a lot shorter than what I did. Yeah. Yeah. No, not less interesting. No, because I pray to God that a minister or a priest, an imam, any kind of teacher, would say from the depths of their own yearnings what I'm saying. Which is not to say they have to sound like me, wear a kippah, you know, say the word Torah, but I think just as Christianity and Islam have dark moments, Judaism has dark moments too. And I don't whitewash them, I just don't incorporate them into what we call, or at least what I try to get us to call, Torah here. You know, kashrut in many ways, in its origins, was a rejection of the other. That's not what kashrut is anymore. I don't teach kashrut as a rejection, I teach kashrut as mindful practice. And I think the same is true about many different canonical teachings within Christianity. Some of them are absorbed, some of them are not. In fact, the Pope's recent decision to reincorporate the Latin sections of Mass, which are anti-Semitic in their origins, resembles a turn in the wrong direction. I can say that as an outsider only if I agree with the legitimacy of the other. How can I critique if I reject the whole system? I'm not pointing to a nuanced problem. I'm saying the whole thing is wrong. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying the whole thing could be right. But anything within a particular faith that rejects another particular, I think, defies the universality of God, which we call one. The Echad of the Shema means we can reach to Echad. But if we want to be all alone, all we have to do is say the word Echad, forget Shema. Some say yes. To David's question, what do I do? If I accept this framework of the Torah trying to explain something, Deuteronomy as a later retelling of the whole first four books, and then Torah as a term that could refer to prophets, or to rabbinic thinking as the rabbis internally describe their own work, which is so brazen. It's very cool, actually. First of all, I define Torah as Rabbi Eli Spitz does. He's a wonderful teacher and author. He says, Torah is the unfolding narrative of the Jewish people. Well, I see the Torah, right, Torah is a verb, you know, to quote a different well-known author, although he says God is a verb. I mean, Torah, what do I do with Torah is really the question, right? What do I do with codified yearning? Because there are verses that I think should be read in their contextual form and rejected. Not shifted in their meaning. Actually, Edna made this point really powerfully yesterday, that if we shift the meaning of any part of Torah, we have to be very careful because the impact that shift, that conscious change has, resonates way beyond. Right? Because once I say that Leviticus 18 and 20 need to be reread, or not read, or retranslated, or not translated, I never say they should be ripped out of the scroll. Then the question is, what do I do with it? Who should be reading that? Should we be reading it? When should we be reading it? The relationship with an inherited tradition, I think, is incredibly woven into this. But in order to have it authentically, and I know that that's a really dangerous word to use in this sentence, in order to have the relationship with Torah and the way Gilman would have us, and the way I want to have it personally, is to not live in one moment of reading the text. That's why mythic time is the entry point. Because if I want to have a relationship with the text such that I am... It's fair for me to judge it. It's fair for me to stand in right face to face with it, like the Kruvim face each other. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But I got to be standing there. And one of the messages of the Kruvim that I didn't point to was that, remember, the cherubs are rooted, made from the same material as the cover for the ark. Well, if I want to have a confrontational or loving relationship with this thing we call Torah, We could also call it Judaism. I have to be made of the same stuff. It doesn't mean I have to be originally made in the same stuff. It means I have to find myself, just I could never pull myself away from it. I cover the Torah with my wings as I face and grapple. So the question is, what do I do with Torah, period? Deuteronomy is not a date. It's just a chapter. It's a holy chapter, but so is the one we're writing. I just can't let go of that in order to get where we might be, might go. So, thank you.